No fun at all. Let's see, are we not still not gone live yet, but
Said the stream is live over here.
it does. Oh, says that I'm live over here too.
No, it
Oh.
just popped on the screen over here. The stream is
Okay. Yep. All right, cool. I'm live on my end too. All right, all right, all right. How we doing, Robert?
good, Dan. How's it going, man?
Good. Good to see you again, man. It's been a couple 3 months.
Yeah, it has. Well, back in Scottsdale, and that's the first time that I've met you. We didn't really have a lot of time to hang then, but this time in Sedona, I think we'll have more time.
Yeah, I actually met you in Sedona first with Graham Hancock, but
That's
we
right.
barely had any time to talk then, so I'm not surprised you didn't remember that. There was a lot of people there, and yeah, I had a lot of people that I was talking to there as well. Yeah, Scottsdale was a lot of the same, but yeah, we got a chance to actually sit down and chat then.
Yeah, that was a little more time. I forgot about the grammar.
I'm not surprised. Like I said, you were busy, man. You were running like mad.
It was warp speed. I was running from one thing to the next. And while I was running, people were trying to stop me. Hey, could I stop you just for a quick question? I was like, no such thing. Yeah, it kept talking with me.
Yeah, I felt bad. A lot of people that I was talking to, I had to just end the conversation before they were. So many people wanted to give me 2 hours of information. I'm just like, I'm only here for a couple of days, but I'm in Sedona. I'm going to be there. I'm coming on the 30th, and I'm going to be there till at least the 4th. And if we end up doing any of the tour stuff afterwards, which is a possibility, I'll be around for that as well. So I'm going to have time to, even in Scottsdale, I took time to two different people that had presentations and stuff that I went to their hotel rooms and sat down and watched their videos that they hadn't put on YouTube, or their PowerPoint presentation in one case. And so yeah, I'm trying to make sure and listen to everybody's stuff. It's hard to read those emails, but in person, it's really easy to sit down and be like, hey, here's what I'm thinking, and give them 45 minutes.
Yeah, I was, wanting to dive a little bit into your channel, debunking, and what brought you to that. You've probably told this story before, but I'm interested in how you got to this place, because you've been on Joe Rogan now and Piers Morgan, and that must be, kind of surreal, right?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I mean, honestly, meeting Graham was a lot bigger of a deal to me, because I've been a fan of Graham Hancock since the 90s. Like, I pre-ordered Fingerprints of the Gods, because so from Hastings, I'd read Sign and the Seal already. So like, my copy, when I had him sign that, and Santa signed Heaven's Mirror. And both of those are just beat to hell copies, right? At this point, they'd been around the block. But what got me making my YouTube channel is, I've been reading this stuff forever, been reading ancient history stuff forever. And my son, I got custody of my son a little over 10 years ago. I've helicopter parented him. He got to the point where he's like, "Dad, helicopter somewhere else, would you?" Because he's a teenager now. So I started watching Graham Hancock stuff again. I saw Ancient Apocalypse, and I'm like, okay, in this day and age, you got to have YouTube debunkers. I wonder what they say. And it was disappointing. It was like watching a bunch of creationists debunk evolution. They didn't know the topic. They didn't know the material. It was like, I don't really. They're just attacking straw men. And when people had told them. People would say, hey, that's not what Graham's real position is. You're just taking one little tidbit and extrapolating in the wrong direction. And they're saying, oh, it's not up to me to look at all of his stuff. It's just up to me to discuss what he put in this episode. And I'm like, is that how you do evolution? Oh, well, that's what Charles Darwin said. So I don't care what any of the other science says. I just am attack this one statement. This isn't a path to truth. This is attacking a man. And so I started making videos responding with science. Instead of saying, you guys are a bunch of conspiracies, you guys are a bunch of alphabet people, you're part of the dark web, or what, you're the hands that's manipulating this all. Instead of doing that, I just went and played by their playbook. You're wrong here scientifically, you're wrong here scientifically, logically you don't make any sense. And at one point, I realized that I was basically by myself. There was nobody else doing that. It was a response video I did to Emperor Tiger Star. His He covered Fingerprints of the Gods, and it was so bad that I had less than 1,000 subscribers. He had 250,000 subscribers when I responded to his video and told him he took his video down because he saw that it was just horrible. He couldn't find anything because he didn't look, because debunking Graham Hancock was like debunking flat earthers. Talk smack, get some clicks, cha-ching, cottage industry, which is exactly what we talked about in Sedona, right? It was about the debunking industry, is what, as Graham called it, and it's very much what it is.
Yeah, I was surprised, when all that came out, Graham Hancock, the most dangerous man on Netflix. I was like, what? Okay. I known Graham's work since about 2005. I came to it indirectly through a friend. And Graham is just known for being impeccable. And when I saw that the American Archaeology Society had basically created a narrative, a hit piece, that Graham's some kind of white supremacist racist, and just turned that article loose. And if you go and Google even now, Graham Hancock, most dangerous man, conflict, whatever. It'll be pages and pages and pages of all these university professors and so on, of academia, just repeating the same thing in a slightly different way. Like they got the script, go run with it, and just, adapt it to make it sound like it's really you putting this out. And that just is disgusting because what are they spending their time for? Again, like you said, they're attacking the man and not bringing a better argument to the table instead. So that, yeah, like you said, that's what Sedona was all about last year's fight for the past. And when Graham aptly, appropriately titled it that, I was like, wow, spot on. That's it. That's the title.
Yes, Santa made me laugh really ha hard at that event. We were outside and it's hot. We're standing out there talking for about an hour. And finally she fans herself and goes, "I need to go in before I get darker." And Graham becomes even more of a racist. I was just like, "Oh fuck." I couldn't stop laughing. Excuse my French. It just killed me. She caught me completely unawares. But, that is, that's the kind of thing that deeply hurts Graham. Graham's a very spiritual person. I'm, for lack of a better way of putting it, I'm really not. I mean, it's not that I'm not. I'm more jaded or more thick-skinned. So if somebody calls me a racist, I just make a your mama joke and just carry on with what I'm doing. It's when it's when they becomes like when it starts to get a little bit of teeth. And I could see where with Graham it did have a little bit of teeth because the way that they're doing this is effectively, not only is it just it's not just attacking the man instead of the idea, they're actually bringing in people that really don't care. Like if you tell somebody, "Hey man, this guy's got the wrong opinion on the pyramids," so what? I'm playing Fortnite, leave me alone. But then you tell them, "Hey, this guy's got the wrong opinions on the pyramids and it's racist." 10% of those people are going to put down their controller and get up and do something. And that's exactly why they do it. It's so cheesy and so underhanded and so manipulative that it's I was really surprised. It's one of the things that I this internet culture of social media letting dumbasses like me get out there and talk to millions is great for a guy like me, but it's been really bad for science because science used to filter who they let us see. That we saw Carl Sagan, we didn't see Flint Dibble. And there was a reason for that. They know what happens when we start seeing Flint Dibbles. This, we end up in this position where nobody trusts them anymore.
Yeah, it seems like it's more about let's get rid of the results and the stronger argument that Graham may be bringing to the table, and let's just mislead everybody from the beginning. That's another thing that pissed me off, is because then you take genuinely curious, honest people who think they're you know, doing a justifiable thing and a righteous thing, and you turn them off to the potential that they could look into and also take away their own critical thinking, to get them to come into this mob mentality and just rip anyone who seems to fall into the category that we deem, you know, offensive, and let's cancel them.
it's so the irony of it being couched as we are fighting false information is just it's how these guys sleep, but that's beyond me. It's like, you know you're lying about stuff. The lies they've told about me personally, that they'll take a video, edit me out of context, and it's to the point where, I mean, the way I explain it to my friends, so I don't have to get into all the details of my video, it's like, if I had a video of me working at a till, and I put a $10 bill in and pulled out two $5 bills in change and put that in my pocket, that pulled the 10 out of my pocket, these guys would edit the last half of it and accuse me of stealing. This happens all the fucking time to me, and way more to Graham. Way more to Graham. That when he was on Rogan in a debate with Flint, and he says, and Joe asks him, he goes, well, is it fair to say in what they have and what they have searched that they haven't found any evidence for an advanced lost civilization? And Graham says, yes, in what they have searched. But this quote always gets cut into just that. They just got through talking about before that. They're talking about Antarctica. They're talking about the continental shelves. They're talking about the Amazon rainforest. There's very specific locations that are mentioned that are the context of this quote, but they don't give a rat because they can weaponize that soundbite. And, you know, I often compare it to Norm Macdonald did his bit where he's talking about how, you know, Norm Macdonald, the comedian, he did a bit about Hitler's dog, and he's like, and now this is the part, where's the problem? And he goes, he's imitating Hitler's dog, and he runs up and he goes, you're all right, Goebbels, but that Adolf Hitler is the greatest man alive. And he's like, all right, you guys go take that sound bite. And that's exactly it. That's exactly what they do. They take this out of context, tongue in cheek stuff, and use it as, well, he really meant that. Again, to say that we're fighting pseudo information, we're fighting disinformation while you do that is just, it's grotesque.
Yeah, and you know, the whole point of why Graham's bringing back this information or bringing up this information at all is just to show our origins. He's not trying to put a winner or a loser, who's here, who's there. He's just presenting the evidence of other people's work who are real scientists out there in the field, just as Graham is. He goes to all these places himself. He doesn't just talk about them off the cuff. And that's a lot more credible. And his whole point is, here's the potential, here's what I think it looks like. And it kind of leaves it up to you. What do you think? And the whole academia seems to be oriented in lockstep with a lot of other institutions to just tell a specific narrative, whether it's our history is only 6,000 years old or whatever it is, because I'm sure there might be a lot of theocracies that would have issue with that. But it's weird. They're all, I mean, the World Economic Forum, the antiquities ministries, education systems, you know, media outlets, they all seem to be singing the same tune. Let's not look over here.
You know, it's weird. A year ago, I felt a lot less like that was the case than I do now. I felt like it was just more of an individual acts of hubris, like on individual personal things one at a time but the elongated skull thing, the more that I do cover that, the more I dig into that, the more that I find they are actively hiding the information now. If you look up the island of Nui, they used to practice artificial cranial deformation. There's a skull there that in the record that was 96% as wide as it is tall. So you imagine that football shaped Stewie Griffin looking person. I would love to take a look at this skull, but there's no images of it in the record anymore. The skull, well, it's been repatriated and it's in a museum, and they won't tell you where it, you can't see it unless you've got the right credentials. And if you go look online and look for it, you'll find that Google's AI and Gemini and Grok and stuff, they just tell you that it doesn't exist, that Nui didn't have this happen. But then you go read old accounts and you find that it does exist. There's a map from like 1936 that shows the distribution of modified craniums throughout the world. And then there's a map from like 19, or excuse me, from like 2016 that shows the same thing. And the 2016 map is missing numerous locations that the older map had, including Hawaii, that we know. Like, there's no question. It's just that's actively being, and that's where, like, again, I'm pretty skeptical about these kind of things. Like I said it to begin with, I try to play by their rules. I don't like to say you guys are all part of the conspiracy. But when I actively see things being disappeared, all I got, I don't have to say a whole lot. Just hold it up and go, what the fuck, guys? Where's the info going? And then when I hear nothing but silence, well, you can leave it to me to imagine. It's not complicated what's going on then. If you guys won't answer the question, somebody's hiding something. It's happening all across the entire Pacific region right now.
And there's many other instances in history too. The one I think of most here in the Southwest is the 1909 Kincaid thing that David Hatchett Childress always speaks about, where Kincaid, you know that story, right?
Yes, but you go ahead and tell it for the viewers that don't.
Yeah, so this guy Kincaid, who was an expeditionary, he was hired by the Smithsonian to do an expedition down the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. He comes up to this one place and sees what looks like a whole bunch of talons from mining spread out all over the ground, climbs up to an opening, and it turns out to be like a Cappadocia place in Derinkeryu in Turkey, where there's this big underground place where tens of thousands of people could live, and there's Asian artifacts, Buddhist statues, Egyptian, all that kind of stuff that he described. Well, the Arizona Gazette in 1909 publishes this and, tells about all this big story. 2 days later, they retracted and said, no, turns out it was just a hoax. And supposedly the Smithsonian came in and took everything out, locked it up. And today, even today, there's a no-fly zone over parts of the northern part of Grand Canyon. Like, maybe it's not the northern part, but I think it's the northern part. There's a whole no-fly zone over Grand Canyon. You can't go there. It's heavily protected.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy when you think about it. And even if the reports were completely wrong or messed up, which it's always funny to me, first of all, that we're not talking about 500 years ago reports. We're talking about real modern reports. It's always funny to me the way that they'll disregard with something that somebody says. It's like, oh, this guy was good at taking measurements over here, but when he measured those bones and he said they were 7 foot tall, I don't know. Maybe he forgot how to use his tape measure that day. It's like, okay, guys, this is just bleh. So, but even if you just take the most skeptical route with it and say there is nothing like that over there. Why are you hiding it? Why is the government so? There are a few places that you can go on the planet in the United States that the government will crawl up your ass as fast as it will that part of the Grand Canyon, right? So it that at that point it gets, again, same kind of thing. It's like I don't need to have a smoking gun of what's going on to know that there's a cover up, and I don't need to. The very fact that I'm not allowed to do something is a cover up. But I compare it a lot of times to if you go to a hotel and you're leaving at the end of the thing and they hand you a bill of all of your services and you're like, hey man, I got a question. about some of these things. Can you show me an itemized bill? And they're like, oh, we don't do that here. All of a sudden, you're going to peak up. If you walk out the door and they don't hand you a bill when you ask for one, you're going to be suspicious as to why. And that's the same kind of thing. It's like, when you won't let us look, when you tell us we can't go, then you turn around and say, well, what are these guys, a bunch of conspiracy theorists? It's like, dude, your wallet turns up missing and I won't let you search my pockets. Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. It's, come on now, don't, you're being stupid. There's a, why can't I go there? Answer the damn question.
Yeah, it's almost notorious of me every time I'm told I can't do something. The first question that comes to mind is why? And then almost consciously or not, I'll end up doing it somehow or some way. There's something about, it must be the human nature or at least Scottish nature, Scottish blood. Every time you tell them not to do something, that's the very thing you'll find them doing. So.
Freedom! Old Mel Gibson style,
That's something like that.
I know my history or cinematography, one of the two.
To take a quick segue since you brought it up on the giants. I've heard stories about giants everywhere I traveled to Peru, Chile, Patagonia, Easter Island, Tahiti, New Zealand, Japan, Hawaii. They all talking about giants as if it's a matter of fact, not a, a myth of a relic to the past. So if that's going around, and in fact, when I was in Okinawa, I saw, because they have the blonde hair, blue-eyed giants all over the South Pacific. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah, I heard a little about it.
So in Japan, you actually see statues of this guy. He's got big blonde hair, and he's got a giant stone he's lifting up and he's throwing. But in Okinawa, we pulled up this one place and I see this bronze statue. And I was like, wow, that dude looks kind of like European. What's a bronze statue doing here? So I went over to read the story, and it's about the blonde hair, blue-eyed giant that came from, I think it was Iliamote, over to Ishigaki to save the islanders from one or the other being attacked. So he saved the island, and they've got on the school, on the elementary school, this like happy blonde haired giant that they celebrate even today. Why would you do that? That's silly. Especially in an Asian culture. Just so bizarre. So what I've seen in the travels that I've done, and I keep hearing mythologies like Joseph Campbell brings up all the similarities in the architecture, the sacred geometry, the ancient stories, the myths. Why are they so similar if there's nothing to it?
I was mentioning those maps of the distribution of elongated skulls earlier. They are all around the coastal areas of pretty much the entire planet. Like it's all over. And so, people, the idea that there was no contact between the old world and the new 10,000 years ago to me is absurd. 20,000, 30,000 years ago, we know Neanderthal took boats to Java. So if, the first time that some kid got in an argument with his dad and he knew how to hop on a boat and fish, he was potentially the next settler to the new world, right? And this isn't complicated. This is really, especially when you take in lower sea levels and islands you can see. So the idea of the connection around the world makes a lot of sense. And when you get to the to return to the giants, like in Georgia, the mounds there that are talked about a lot here in the States, the guy that dug those up was a well-known scientist. I forget his name, but he was well respected. And he wasn't a slouch, and he was measuring like 7 foot 6, 7 foot 4, nothing absurd, nothing out of the realm of what we could expect, what's naturally possible. However, it is on the big side, especially when you start averaging it. So all that stuff is housed in the Smithsonian, like you said. And what's really, really interesting, this is one of the funniest things when people, because everybody, oh, the Smithsonian hides giant bones, and then everybody laughs at that, says it's stupid. Well, There is one, there's the law NAGPRA. It's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. And this says that if there is a Native American fingernail, that it gets repatriated to the tribe, it does not belong in a museum. There is one institution, if any of your viewers don't believe me, you can just go down and Google it right now. There's one institution in the United States that's immune to NAGPRA, and it's the Smithsonian. It does not have to comply to NAGPRA. Gee, I wonder why that is. They don't want to repatriate some of these bones. Some of these things we're just going to hang on to, buddy. We're just going to keep. You have the ones that are over there, the ones in our museum, not available.
Yeah, and again, all of that circles back to why they would go after someone like Graham, just to make sure people aren't asking certain questions. I mean, if Graham were talking about a different story, and he has been an author for many years, they may have not been very interested.
Yeah, and see, and it seems so weird to me because, like I said, I've always just assumed that it was, you know, personal hubris. You're an academic. You've wrote 20 papers on the peopling of the Americas. Somebody like Graham comes along, they're kicking the tires on all your arguments, and basically, if he's right, your life's work is wasted. Well, of course that guy's going to dig his heels in. I would expect anything less. But the skull thing, man, that would really, the deleting of evidence, when it just gets harder to find data as time goes on, and the excuses they give, oh, well, you know, the native tribes, the indigenous tribes across the Pacific don't believe that you could see a drawing of one of these skulls, or it's somehow evil, bad juju or whatever. And that might be the case in certain places, but, you know, the Amish have that kind of belief with certain groups of Amish, but the Mennonites don't. And they live right next door to each other in Pennsylvania Dutch country, and they both had the same beliefs a couple hundred years ago. You tell me these islanders, thousands of years removed from each other, all have the same belief? Bullshit. Bullshit. This is an excuse. And the ultimate slap in the face is, if you got the right letters next to your name and you're willing to pay the money to go to those museums, you can still put your hands all over those little things. They don't care. Another great example of this, real quick, sorry to babble on this, but the skull cover-up really does infuriate me. And one of the greatest examples is when Nelson Rockefeller bought four skulls from Paracas, Peru, and he cherry-picked four skulls, paid $40,000 for four skulls. They were displayed at the Met. They were displayed at the National History Museum in New York. Then they were repatriated, and, well, there's no photographs of them at the Met. There's no photographs of them at the National History Museum in New York. There's no drawings of them that exist at all. The Peruvian government doesn't have them on display because they don't know which ones they are. They were repatriated, and we don't know. We just threw them in the box. Bullshit. They were sold right. They never left the States. They were sold to somebody else, probably right there in New York City. That's what happened. And this is, it's so painfully obvious. It's, and the reason that I babble about that side of it is because we know that there is some artificial cranial deformation. There's also guys like Brian Forrester who believe that quite a few of these were natural. Well, which ones do you think Rockefeller would have bought? The ones that looked natural or the ones that looked fake? This is the problem. They're cherry picked by the time we get to touch them. And then they take and say, oh, you can't read the cool ones. 96% as wide as it is tall. Doesn't exist. Come on.
Well, what it makes me think of is that the elongated skulls, it just sounds so bizarre anyways, that everyone's going to go, oh, come on. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, I know a lot of indigenous people, especially here in the Southwest. I have a lot of indigenous friends from the res. And for them, you know, the gods are a reality. It's not a myth. It's not imagination. And if you tell them otherwise, they're going to get pissed.
Yeah.
Or they're going to keep it to themselves, and they're going to be pissed anyways, but not let you know that they're going to be pissed. But for them, it's so real. And the UFOs and everything we talk about, for them, that's just the gods. So it makes me think about, you remember in the Solomon Islands after World War II, and all the islanders started making replica planes
Cargo cults. Yeah, I talk about those a lot. Yes.
and all of those types of things. So maybe, potentially it's either another species, that's the elongated skulls, or potentially, off-world species. And if they were emulated as gods, or if they were thought of as gods, then the other ones would be emulating them so that they could acquire their traits.
Yeah, that's I. It's an interesting thing that the in the Pacific Northwest, the Native Americans believed that it was like it made you smarter. It made you not just more beautiful, but it made you smarter. It made you more in tune with the gods to have your head deformed. So it's and it's a very common belief all throughout the Pacific Islands and stuff that it was something associated with greater intelligence, being shrewd, being smart, wise. So it is an interesting thing that it seems there's a very good possibility, and like a lot of people think it's aliens, and my being the skeptical type, I immediately my first one is another species of hominid. Or even like you could really get crazy with it. It takes one Einstein to really change the landscape on something. You could have had one dude that was just a damn mutant McNugget a long time ago, but he was really smart. And so people were like, yeah, I kind of want my kid to look like that mutant McNugget. And so here we are thousands of years later, and people still, it's weird how things take off, but you know where the word salary came from, right? So Romans paid their people in salt. And so, like we still say, salary. We still say that guy's not worth his salt. Nobody's been paid in salt in our world in thousands of years, but we still. So it is possible that just something that took off at one time could have. That's the way the Richard Dawkins version of memes work. If you are familiar with that, like just the ideas that. Thinking of ideas that travel between people's minds as like an evolutionary organism, and they it's whether or not they survive and die and thrive, like happy birthday. Who invented that? How long's it been going? Who knows, right? It just goes. It goes and goes and goes.
Well, what do you think about the off-world possibility? And it seems like you're saying there's a lot of the natural skulls spread around all over the world.
All
And
over the
one more
world.
question, have you ever looked at a gorilla skull? Like when you see a gorilla from the side, he has a really big extended, especially the male, has kind of an extended skull.
I haven't actually looked at the gorilla skull and put thought into that, actually. No, I haven't. That's interesting. As far as the alien thing, no, it's less like. It's less likely than a hominid on Earth. I think anybody would agree that that is, it's a less likely possibility. But using that kind of skeptical thinking, it's one of the things that is really funny to me. The idea that like we were that Mars had life on it, and that's where humans on Earth came from, right? That's something that a lot of people just discount as crazy. Just that's just nut job stuff. But okay. If you ask anybody, they're going to say there's probably life out there in the universe, right? Okay, I mean, the odds are insurmountable. So now, if you accept that there's probably life out there in the universe, now we know we have organisms on this planet, like those little water bears, those tardigrades, and you can just chuck them out into the galaxy and they just fly around and land, and they're viable when they potentially viable when they hit the ground after radiation and freezing temperatures and vacuum. And we so. If we know that there's life in this solar system, and we know that some of that life is viable after it, potentially viable after it travels from one rock to another, if you accept that there's probably life out in the solar system, isn't it a higher out in the universe? Isn't there a higher probability there's probably life on another rock in the solar system? I mean, this is, and it's just pure science here. I'm not trying to, or logic with, I'm not trying to get all like they necessarily came from Mars and settled here or anything. It just, purely from that perspective, we know there's life here. So there's radiating out from here. There's possibly, it only makes sense. So the way that that's treated, my point of bringing this up is the way that they treat the idea of transpermia or of life on another planet here in the solar system is just absolute ridiculous horseshit. That's a knee-jerk emotional reaction that really hasn't thought about it.
What
Off
about
my soapbox, sorry.
fungi arriving here 3 to 4 billion years ago, and that we're part fungi?
That's an interesting one. The way that we how do you, the way that we like label and categorize different things. I mean, there was recently they were talking about they discovered this new type of life that was kind of a bridge between animals and plants that existed a long ass time ago. Odds are that kind of stuff happens all the time. I mean, they have these problems with like meme viruses, which are these viruses that are so big, they've got so many genes that sometimes they got more genes than a viable cell, but it's a virus. It still needs a cell to reproduce. So what's going on here? This isn't live, but it's more complicated than life over on the next circuit over. So a lot of these things we kind of pigeonhole. But the idea of mushrooms and other animals and stuff like working together to a degree. I know it sounds silly, but I did a video on this a while back, and any stimuli that you put in an environment, life will evolve. Some life forms will evolve to use. You got no light, you're not going to evolve eyes. But if you put light in that area, you will have creatures evolve eyes. If there's sound, creatures will evolve means of detecting that sound. In forests, they know that if you crush a tree's leaves, it kicks out a chemical signal that says, "Hey, I'm being eaten over here." If you go stomping on mushrooms, it same thing. I think it's stupid to assume that we haven't, that some species and quite possibly humans haven't somehow tuned into that on some fundamental level, and we might only recognize that as a sixth sense or a weird feeling in the back of our neck as we're walking through the woods at night. But the reality of it is, I think it's probably a very real scientific thing to it that. People really don't understand how little we actually know. It's like people think that we've scientifically studied everything. There are thousands of species of bugs in Arizona deserts where it's dry that they have now, they don't even have a common name. There's spiders that they haven't even tested their bites on, that there's zero reported bites of having happened in Arizona, in New Mexico, in Washington, all across the United States. Tens of thousands of species of bugs that are unidentified. So we don't know shit, man. We don't know shit. So this idea that science is just like, eh. So we are in Plato's cave. That's where science has us right now. We're like trying to, we know we're in the cave. We got that far, but we're in the cave. Again, sorry, off the soapbox again.
No, that's fine. I like it, Dave. That's good.
Thanks.
I mean, Dan, sorry. Well, on another tangent, and back to the event coming up in Sedona, we're going to have an after tour. If we get enough people, we got a tour for those people who are already coming to town. You want to stay on? David Childress is going to join us for a road trip around sites here in the Verde Valley, Sedona, and Flagstaff up near Grand Canyon. We'll check out the Meteor Crater, and also, there's a mine here in Jerome. I don't know if you know about it. At one time, it was the largest copper mine in the world, and by 1952, it had pulled out 14 pounds of copper for every person on the planet. And at that time, there was like 3 billion people on the planet. And it was also at one time the richest city in America before everybody came and fleeced it. But there's some great ancient sites around here. There's Tuzegu, there's Vibar V petroglyphs, which is the largest panel in the Verde Valley. But also, when you brought up salary and salt, there's a salt mine in the Verde Valley, that we'll go check out on the way to Meteor Crater. So I think that's interesting because salt would have been a really super important commodity, very valuable, much more valuable than it is today. To know where the salt is, to, as people in this region came from all over northern Arizona to go to this salt mine over here.
Oh, wow.
So, and then there's also the most northern ball court at Waupaki that we'll check out. So I hope we get to check out some of those things. As long as we have enough people to take the tour, we're going to be doing it. We need 8 to 10 people if we're really going to do it, and we're all set and ready to go. We've got a good crew. We've done these tours many times, and we've got our own grills. So we're going to be prepping our own food for lunch and dinner, so we don't have to eat at restaurants, and we can enjoy the nature here.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
That's
the price down, you know, so that people can make a last minute journey if they still want to, you know, squeeze in a spring break excursion.
Yeah, the airplane thing is too bad. That definitely pinched some people's plans. I know that for sure. But
yeah, the TSA being stuck, that really slowed things down. But the ironic thing, as soon as the TSA got better, ticket sales just started going off the hook again. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. But still, you know, it's hard for people to make a last minute trip in 3 weeks. But David Hatchett Childress, that doesn't come every day. It's taken me 10 years just to get David to commit to these things. And he's just a wealth of knowledge, man. And having.
He's a joy to talk to. He's just a nice guy.
He's a super nice guy. Yeah. Yeah. Plus, you know, like what he likes to do at his World Explorers Club, he's got pinball machines and a pool table. So he likes to hang out, play pinball, and play pool. And we talk about these topics come up, and then bing, bing, it just goes all over the place. One topic leads to another. We'll be there 2 hours easily, you know. If we don't stop ourselves, it'll keep going.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. I want to check out that ball court. So I really hope we get a chance to do it. When I try and eating on the road like that, man, I love that. When I travel up here in the Pacific Northwest, I've always got a little propane stove in the trunk of the car and a skillet, and I'll cook my breakfast on road trips and stuff by the rivers all the time. That's way better than stopping at a restaurant.
Yeah, it's so much nicer, and you know, you spend half of your time getting in the place, getting organized, getting your order, and then there's all the other distraction that's going on at the same time, and it's just cool to hang out in nature and eat outdoors, you know. I've done that all my life as well, so I really enjoy that.
Yeah, it's definitely, I don't know what it is, it's just something about parking your car, jumping out, taking 10 steps, and sitting down by the side of the river and cooking a meal. That's just, it just feels so powerfully humanly natural. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm surprised really that ball court, man.
What's that?
I'm so excited about that ball court. I haven't got a chance to ever see one of those in person. So I'm like, ooh, I want to go.
Oh, it's super cool, man. And the ruins that are there, there's also Lamaki close by and Mukoki. And they're unique in themselves, but Waupaki is like, it was a big living place, several, you know, living quarters. And right next to the ball court, they have this thing they call the blowhole. So they built a structure around it, but this hole goes down into the ground into a subterranean, ancient underwater aquifer. And the water down there is tens of thousands of years old. But the thing that happens is when the temperatures are changing, especially when it's hot upstairs, it pulls up all this cool air from the aquifer. So you can put your head over it. My hair would be standing on end, you know, it's flowing out so fast.
That's awesome.
It's amazing. It's like, whoa, okay, here's another example. It looks so primitive. But is it, you know, engineering, where did you get the thought for this even to be a thing in the first place? Was it just there? I don't know.
It
And
is trial and error. That's the stuff that always gets me on those. How did they figure this out? Where's the failed attempts?
yeah, because it takes a long time to learn by trial and error. That's a lot of mistakes and generations. And their structures are, again, they look primitive. They look so simple. Oh, it's a dirt floor. So what? The engineering, the geometry, and everything that goes on, where it's facing, how it cools the space naturally or warms it naturally in different temperatures. That's advanced. That's not primitive.
Thank you. There's when they talk about the way that it's so funny because the mainstream archaeologists will balk at the word primitive, but they'll turn around and they'll say, oh, that's a loaded term. We shouldn't call them primitive. But then they'll turn around and imply that these people were using the same brains that we have now, but doing for scratching in the dirt. And running around with, as Ben Van Kirk likes to say, running around with butt flaps. It's like this is stupid. These guys had they would have had extremely complicated. If you watch how these dudes would gather iron out of a river to make to with a magnet and stuff in order to harvest iron. I mean, these ideas were the different ways that people figured out. Look at what cheese takes to make cheese, just cheese. That's a pretty fucking complicated, man. You don't just put milk on your shelf and it happens, right? And so then it, so there's a lot of the happy accidents that people harnessed, right? And then you get people experimenting with these things. So I get really frustrated when I when they mentioned when they say that they were primitive or something, because it's like these guys were pouring just as much energy and effort and time into things as we do today. Probably more. When they didn't sit around looking at their phones and shit, right? They were anytime you watch a video where some dude goes and chills with a hunter-gatherer from someplace, there's a guy 20 years older than me that's just ripped. He looks like he'd beat the crap out of me when I was 20, right? He was still in the army, right? He just ripped. Because he's doing stuff all day long. He's living. So yeah, their homes and stuff were extremely functional for what they were designed to do. And that's a lot of times, with the fact that a lot of these communities were capable of living in harmony with nature, and I'm not trying to get all noble savage. They never fought with each other and they just ate plants and no. But they had war and stuff, but they were smart. They did things that were intelligent. They did things that made sense. Like if you've ever built an igloo before, you know that you put your sleeping area a good foot up off the ground from where you enter the thing if you can help it. And you do that because heat rises. I know heat rises from science class. An Inuit knows that because his daddy taught him that's how you don't freeze to death. It's not that they're primitive and stupid. So yes, anyway, I always take offense at that one because I think that ancient people thinking that they were dumb is just the dumbest thing ever.
Yeah, I think so too, especially when, the places that I've traveled to, like Peru, you just take Peru and Easter Island, for example, and the stonework they have there, it looks like the same people did the work, first of all. And I do mosaic tile work, and I know how hard it is to get a design to come together with small grout lines. These are giant stones with no space at all in between them. That I can just look at it and go, wow, this is super advanced. We can't even move these rocks. Who's doing that and how are they doing it? And why don't we do it? Why don't we question ourselves? Why don't we do it?
It's funny because like somebody will come along and say, oh, we can move stone of pretty much any size. I mean, we have the technology to move rocket ships, right? We can move anything. Well, okay, sure, fine. But then you look at Sacsayhuamán, where they got them just lined up like teeth, just these giant stones. And it's like that, and the seams between them are really smooth. And it's like, okay, you can lap a stone to make the sides smooth. You could just rub a piece of stone against another piece of stone, and eventually you'll have some paper. You can't fit a knife between the joints. But on this many stones, on this much size, and each one of them, how hard are they to move? Well, according to the one account that we have from that area, from the guy who was half Inca and half Spaniard, he said that like 3,000 people died trying to move one of these big rocks that wasn't even as big as the biggest one that was at the site. And that and because these had been built much longer ago in the past, that's the records as they were passed. It was Garcilaso de la Vega, I believe is his name. But anyway, my point is, yeah, you can take one of these stones and you could spend a bunch of time and make it happen. But then you ask yourself, how did this happen on the scale that you're seeing it? And well, you just throw a lot of people at it. It's like, so what do you think it took? Like, how long do you think it took? Well, in the case of the Great Pyramid, for example, 20 to 30 years. Well, at that point, I'm just gonna, who am I talking to here? Which one of us has a tinfoil hat on, you crazy bastard? You're trying to tell me that they did all this in 30 years? How long does it take for them to build a freeway in your town? Good God. And with modern machinery and all this, it's like, just, and if they would just accept, say, 100-year timeline on the pyramids, even, but they refuse to budge on anything, that's like, if they think it, you mentioned Easter Island and the similarity in the stone to Bolivia. Thor Heyerdahl was the first person to popularize that idea. He was demonized. Thor Heyerdahl, the guy that did the Kon-Tiki voyage. Yeah, he was demonized for that. He was called all kinds of names for making that observation. And DNA just recently, like last year, DNA proved that Easter Island was in contact with South America right out the gate. The earliest
sure.
known habitated layer, which is about 1,000 years old, has evidence of sweet potato and evidence of ginger. So that both crops from South America, crops from Asia in the same place. And there's a South American genetic flow out into Polynesia, and there is a Polynesian genetic flow in South America. Easter Islanders have about 10% South American DNA, if I remember right. But yeah, that study just came out last year as well. So, well, my point there is that Thor Heyerdahl was treated like Graham Hancock is. Yeah, he's a liar. He's an idiot. He's a racist. He's stupid. Thor had some spicy ideas for his day, but they just called him all the names. But he was right. Not entirely, but he was right about. And they wouldn't even, not one point. Not one point would they give it to him on. It's you. They say that science learns from its mistakes, and maybe this is just more evidence that archaeology isn't really a science because it certainly doesn't seem to learn from its mistakes.
It's an observation call. And we control the observation.
That's right. It's so sad.
Well, David Childress is also going to be talking about the Ho-Ho-Kam like he did in Scottsdale and the Empire of Shiva. I don't know if you heard any of his talk, but I
I
just
did.
find it fascinating. And
Yeah, I did.
I can see how, because the Chinese were supposed to be here, there are Chinese petroglyphs out near Zuni. There's a book called The Pale Ink. It was written by a Chinese traveler 2,500 years ago. So there had to be an access from Asia to here in the Southwest. Zuni have sometimes dolphins in their fetishes. How could they know about dolphins if, we knew there used to be an inland sea here, and they talk about the great blue waters and the gray waters. So how would they know that? There's a lot of Japanese words in the Hopi language, and there's a book about that too called The Zuni Enigma, which shows the comparison of these Japanese words. So we have proof that they can come across the ocean, and we know that it's like a highway with the currents on the ocean if you know how to use that and map the stars. So it's all there. And on top of that, the Rongo Rongo script from Easter Island is almost identical to script in the Indus Valley. So David's idea of the Empire of Shiva and coming across the Polynesians, ending up in the Americas, really makes sense. And the Hohokam, because he's saying this culture was called the Cam, and that the Phoenix, the people who lived in the Phoenix areas were called Hohokam, had super cool canals and built them all the way up north. So that's some of the stuff we'll be able to talk to David about when we go on the tour, and he'll go into more with Billy and Randall at the Sedona event.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. My research with the elongated skulls, mostly up where I live in the Pacific Northwest, but it dovetails so heavily with that. Like, for example, Paracas, Peru, right? That's where all those skulls come from. You know, the candelabra of the Andes, the big geoglyph in the ground that looks like candelabra, that's visible from 12 miles out to sea, and it's right there at Paracas. It's like 5 miles from where all those graves were. It's the kind of thing, a lighthouse without a light bulb, right? Here's where we are. Come find us here. It seems like these people were traveling all over that part of the world, and I'm tracking a lot of it as with through the practice of artificial cranial deformation. Like that's the leftover fingerprint of everything else might be different, especially on these islands, because a lot of times the natural resources are so drastically different from place to place. But what doesn't change is a couple of things, as a matter of fact, not just the cranial deformation, the way they bury their dead, even though it changes, has one weird feature. They're always still visible. In Paracas, they put them in grave bundles that you could just, and they just stuck them in the cave. You just walk over, you don't have to, they weren't buried. You just walk over, open the bundle up if you want. In the Pacific Northwest, they put them in canoes and elevated them up off the ground. So when you buried grandpa or you buried dad, grandpa's canoe's right over there. He's still just laying in it. The other one that they used to do up in the Pacific Northwest to a lesser degree was make catacombs out of driftwood. And the same thing, you would just put the dude sitting in there in a bag inside the thing. And it, all over the Pacific Islands and stuff, they would store them in caves. They would just, the burial practices, the practice of that cranial deformation and the burial practice seem to somewhat go hand in hand also with the idea that this was making people smarter. It's like it's very far removed. It's been a long time since these things were all in contact together, but you can see where there is this commonality, this common thread that connects them. And it's not just one thing. It's a few interconnected things. And it's the kind of thing that honestly, you know, I'm not a big believer in way ancient high technology, but I think that it's just as much of a folly to just say that there was no cross-cultural contact in those days, nothing at all. The story of our past is complicated because people are complicated, and there's going to be technologies in there that show up and they get lost because people bring up technologies and then they get lost. I mean, the story of that, when Archimedes was killed by a Roman soldier, he's like sitting there doodling on the ground, and he walks in, he's like, "Hey, shut up, I'm doing some geometry over here," and he runs him through. What was he working on? We'll never know. So.
Well, it's going to be a cool time in Sedona. Looking forward to hanging with you. We've got some cool activities for after the event on Saturday night for hanging out, Friday as well. You know, there's one place we have to have a certain bar tab, and I said, "Oh, don't worry about it. Dan's going to be there, so
it's covered.
You'll be fine."
He'll sell at least 50 beers a night.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
But I'm going to bring for we got a lot of nerds in our community. I'm bringing some, my magic cards, so we'll play magic with any dorks that play magic, and we can drink and smoke the devil's lettuce and wander out in the desert and, you know, look for peyote and fight with scorpions and whatever. I mean, we're going to be in Arizona. It's still cold up here where I'm at, man. It's getting warmer, but it's still pretty chilly. And whew, you know, Arizona's so nice this time. I mean, it's so hot compared to up here. I'm all up there. I'll be walking around.
I didn't think about that. No, it's perfect down here right now. This time in October, September, October, April, May, March, you know, September, October, November. Those are the real sweet spots of the whole year because it's so perfect. The skies are blue with that orange rocks as the backdrop. You know, it's cool. And we got a lot of good food, a lot of good people coming in from many different countries, but all over the country here in the States as well.
And a lot of different perspectives on these things. It's our biggest strength, I think, is that we do what science used to do. We put a bunch of different ideas in the same pot and sift them around. And a lot of that comes from our ability to have conversations without ego with each other, which is one of the things that I love. I can't wait to see a bunch of the familiar faces and a bunch of new ones. It's gonna be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and the the connections with other people, the camaraderie is just palpable in the room, and that's what I really love about making these things happen, is because I know that's an energy, and when we all get together, we're amplifying that energy, and that's fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. It's a thing of beauty. I really enjoyed both of the times I've been there so far to your events, and I'm going to enjoy this one, I'm certain.
Cool, man. Well, thank you again for your time, Dan. And again, we're looking for you're coming in on Thursday, right?
Yeah, I'm coming in on the 30th.
Okay. Well, make sure to give me that time, and
yeah, I will do.
I'm going to organize seeing about having someone pick everybody up.
All right. Cool. Thanks. Yeah, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Awesome. Thanks, right. Robert. Good thank to talk you. To you, bud.
Yeah, thank you for your time, man.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. All right.